That is the Ukrainian national anthem, sung by 7-year-old Amelia Anisovich. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kett, and you may have seen the viral video of Amelia in a bomb shelter singing Let It Go from Disney's Frozen. She sent safely made it across the Ukrainian border to Poland with her grandmother and more than 2 million other refugees from this war. On Sunday, in pigtails and a traditional white dress adorned with red, white, and blue flowers, she sang her national anthem to a sold-out Atlas Arena in Poland, with the stadium lights turned off, but still ablaze by 10,000 lit-up cell phones. The translation of the Ukrainian national anthem is, "Ukraine has not yet perished." Caitlin Farrell is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She went to eastern Poland to report on the war in Ukraine and returned to the U.S. just this past Saturday. Caitlin, welcome back to the Ideas Network, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you spent time with Polish families that are housing Ukrainian refugees, and I'm really curious what the experience is like for both of these sides, these two groups of people forced together by war.
Yeah, so you're right. I did have an opportunity to go inside the home of a Polish family who is housing refugees. And, you know, I spent time in a few homes. And so that was really only a brief snapshot of the thousands of Polish people who are opening their homes to Ukrainian refugees. But it was really an awesome experience to kind of be a part of their evening for the night. I at that time during my reporting trip, I was in Krakow, just outside of the city center, and it was really remarkable just to see and get to know some of the people who have really stepped up to welcome. As you said, you know, I think at this point more than 3 million people have left Ukraine. Many of them are in Poland, and many folks that I spoke to, including the family I spent time with, really want to stay in Poland because they hope the war will end soon and they want to go back to Ukraine. And so I think, you know, despite the fact that in the case of the family that I spoke to, the Polish family, you know, didn't speak Ukrainian or Russian well, and the Ukrainian family, they actually spoke Russian. They didn't speak Polish. It was really cool to see how they talked with each other using Google Translate, you know, typing on their phones and sharing messages back and forth. And they spent time cooking, talked a lot about kind of sharing each other's cuisines. And in this case, you know, they got along really well. And I think, you know, many of the Ukrainians that I spoke to, at least, were just really overwhelmed with the welcome that they had received so far when they had crossed into Poland specifically.
Yeah, Caitlin Farrell, what's the process like for refugees who cross over that eastern border from Ukraine into Poland and are looking for some sort of shelter, and the Polish families that step up to provide that? How does that all come together?
Yeah, so my understanding from when I was, you know, there in the country about a month, and the initial response really was a pure volunteer effort. I think thousands and thousands of Poles really, really stepped up to provide food, set up stations at various entry points across the country. There's several border crossings along the Polish-Ukrainian border where people could enter the country by car, by foot, and then there are train stations as well that were set up, then sort of transformed into border crossings. Some of them weren't even necessarily at the border, but in each place that I was in, I mean, you'd see people coming over into the country and immediately be met by, you know, piles of clothes that they could, coats and things that they could put on. I mean, it was quite cold, still quite cold there, like it is here. You know, food right away, hot soup, a medic station, you know, SIM cards and like data power banks and data packages for their phones.
Oh, wow.
And just recently in the second, you know, I guess, probably 2 weeks ago at this point, the Polish government rolled out a program where folks from Ukraine can register for identification numbers, and in that way they can immediately be enrolled and be eligible for health care and then become enrolled in school. And so I was at a variety of places where, you know, people were waiting in line overnight in order to get those numbers. And so So, the government has since, you know, stepped in and, you know, especially in Poland, have asked the EU and other countries for more help to sustain the support that they're giving these million. I mean, there's 2 million refugees in Poland right now, which is just a huge amount of people. So anyway, it's a really extensive, I thought, really well-organized response.
Caitlin Farrell's an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She spent about a month in eastern Poland covering the people impacted by the Russian war in Ukraine. What do you want to know about the people who are fleeing from there? And what do you want to know about the Polish people who are welcoming them in? 1-800-642-1234. You have family in Eastern Europe? And if so, what short stories would you like to share with us this morning? You can join us also via email, ideas@WPR.org. And Caitlin, as you wrote earlier this month in the Journal Sentinel, you had spent some time in Ukraine about 10 years ago, teaching English as a grad student?
Yep, that's right.
What was that experience like for you then, and how did it, how did you use that experience when you returned to the eastern border of Poland?
So, it's funny how you know, certain things in life come back around again a little bit. I went there and taught English in the western part of Ukraine, in Lviv, the Lviv area, when I was in graduate school, and It was in 2013, shortly before the Maidan protests happened, just later that year and early into 2014. And so at the time, you know, the country really captivated me. The country and its people and the relationships I built with the students I taught just really had a profound impact on me as a person, and my understanding as, you know, what it meant to be an American, and just sort of understanding a lot of the privileges we have here and things we don't really think about or worry about as much that were really on the minds of many of the students that I taught. And I ended up I completely changed my master's thesis topic to write all about the geopolitics of Ukraine. And I think, the relationships I built during that time and the understanding that I came to have about the country and its history and what's important to people there. I mean, especially I think in the western part of the country, but I think, you know, we're obviously seeing it across the whole country now. It makes really what I'm seeing now as far as the resiliency and the commitment of the Ukrainian people to fight for their country just honestly really not surprising. And I think my understanding of the country and its history really helped when I was there talking with Ukrainians who are now leaving. I think I'm really, it's a fascinating place, a culture, you know, quite different than the Midwest, but I think, you know, a lot of similarities as well. And so I left and always would tell people that if you can go visit one place, I think you should visit Ukraine. And, you know, now I hope that I'll be able to get back someday.
Caitlin Farrell from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel joining us. And you read about Dmytro Yosak, Ukrainian who's been working in Krakow, Poland to resettle refugees. He ran the Empire of Beauty Hair Salon, now runs Krakow Help to send supplies to people in need. How common is this? How successful are small grassroots organizations like this? And how, you know, how often did you see him pop up?
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's incredibly common. And I think they're everywhere. I saw a lot of whole variety of grassroots organizations popping up in Poland, in Ukraine still. Many of the folks I know who are still in the country have founded nonprofits that are trying to facilitate supplies and aid entering the country or facilitate people getting out of the country. I mean, there's groups that are working to help people get pets and horses and livestock out of Ukraine. It can be really complicated to get those animals and people over the border. But, you know, you really saw it too, like in the case of Dmytro, I actually went to visit Empire of Beauty, the salon he founded in Krakow. And I mean, he, since the war began, I mean, he's hired several, like six or so, I think, refugees who've come as stylists and nail technicians there. And so I really saw a lot of businesses trying to help in whatever way they could, including giving jobs to people who are displaced and are looking for work, which I think is really a crucial piece of aid. But you saw it walking around some of the border towns and in Krakow particularly, you really could see it all over, just different, you know, food drives, clothing drives. I mean, people, there's a huge stadium in Krakow filled. It's like basically a free Goodwill. And so it's, so yeah, it's been, it was really cool to kind of see how integrated that is.
It's fascinating. Caitlin Farrell is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And I'd ask you, how should the U.S. support refugees in Ukraine and countries that are taking them in? Is there enough food, shelter, and mental health resources as you see it? And what more could we do? We'll take your calls and suggestions at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Saw this story just yesterday. The European Union is beginning to ask refugees from Ukraine to leave Poland and find safety someplace else. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and the UN estimates that more than 4 million people have fled Ukraine since Russia invaded, and more than half of those have made their way safely over the border to Poland. Germany and Poland are now proposing that each refugee there be given 1,000 euros to resettle. So do you have a story to share or a question to ask our guest who just returned from there? 1-800-642-1234 to join us or email ideas@WPR.org. Caitlin Farrell's an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Caitlin, I want to ask you about the things that people carried, the images that show people fleeing Ukraine carrying a backpack or a suitcase and the choices I put myself in their shoes and wonder if I could make about what to leave behind. What did you see about the things that they carried across the border as the refugees tried to make their way to safety?
So we wrote a story kind of looking at those items and using that as a window to sort of discuss, you know, what's important to people and get to know a little bit about their story. I think, honestly, you know, we did talk to many folks who brought something specific, including I spoke with a mother of a teen boy who brought his swimsuits, specific swimsuits, and his swimming outfit, as they called it, to do water polo, which I thought was really interesting. It was, you know, she talked about how her son had been training on this competitive water polo team for years and years, gotten up and done workouts twice a day. And, you know, obviously the war stopped that, and how they didn't know where they, I saw them in Kelm, the train station in Kelm in Poland. And, you know, he didn't know where or when he could be swimming again, but really hoped to do that. And so it was really just sort of an interesting way to sort of look at how the war has interrupted, you know, normal activities in people's lives that they've spent years, you know, cultivating. A lot of people we spoke to too, I mean, really just had one bag, often like a small bag or just a backpack, and said that, you know, the most important thing that they left so fast in such a hurry that often they didn't even think about bringing a sentimental item. It was really just their documents that was the most important thing. And so, but we spoke with the woman too, who had taken her grandmother's earrings, some jewelry, reminding you know, her of family. So that was a common one too. But I was struck too by just how quickly people left and just what little actually they carried with them, to be honest.
Mona from Appleton called. She had to run, but she saw a Facebook post about a kid raising money to help animals trapped in Ukraine. Seen a few of those photos too, Caitlin. And I don't know any cat or dog lovers who would be able to leave their cats or dogs behind.
Yeah, so it's interesting that she raised that. So because there's some kind of interesting nuances there. There's actually requires more documentation, I learned, to bring your pet across the border than for bringing a human across the border, or as a human crossing the border. So, and there's some restrictions on what kinds of pets you could bring, but like birds, for example, and like horses, things like that, I think were a lot more complicated, and you have to only enter at certain crossings to bring those. But yeah, a lot of people would bring dogs. I didn't see quite as many cats, but lots of dogs at the train station. And I think But, you know, also, as she noted, I think a lot of people having to leave dogs behind. And I've also read stories about groups trying to reunite pets with their owners, where people might leave a pet somewhere and write their phone number, you know, on a tag and hope that someone can find the pet and call and help have them reunited. But yeah, you had to have paperwork for your pet. And in some cases, your pet had to be examined by a veterinarian official at the border for it to leave Ukraine, which could complicate things. But it was interesting to see that even the infrastructure too, though, built up around people supporting their pets. So at every train station I was at, and at the border crossings too, there were leashes and like dog coats and little carriers and water, bottles of water, you know, a bin for dog food and cat food. And, you know, the train station in Krakow, there was a whole like pretty extensive stand of nice, you know, new pet supplies that people could just walk up and grab whatever they needed for their dog that just volunteers were providing, not the government in that case. And so, they're members of the family, and it's interesting to kind of see that.
Caitlin Farrell, investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, taking your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234. We're Bill from Milwaukee standing by. Bill, good morning.
Good morning. Leave my dog behind, the very idea. I would sit under a bomb with my dog.
And I think some did.
I'm sure. I think the way Poland is showing such an outpouring of real human affection and kindness to the refugees, this stand that takes care of dogs, that's remarkable to me. I think America should lavish Ukraine with support in every aspect. And I hope my fellow Americans understand that we can't just walk in there and take this bully out. We'd love to, but we can't, and neither can NATO, but we cannot. What we can do is support them. What I'd like to ask the reporter is, how are the Ukraine people handling this war around them? Are there people who are still living in their houses and going on about their lives? However weird that may sound, this is a large nation, and I wonder if there are people who have the war going on around them, but it hasn't hit them yet, and are they still living their lives?
Bill, thank you. What do we, from your reporting, Caitlin, what do we know about what's happening in Ukraine and those who stayed behind? And you did have a story about folks who were actually going into Ukraine as well.
Yeah, so that is a good question. And it's kind of funny that it came up, actually, because, a couple things. There are people, at least a few weeks ago when I was focusing on this element that are going into Ukraine. I mean, there's been quite a lot of reporting about even, you know, U.S. former service members and other volunteers who are going in to help fight with the Ukrainian army. President Zelensky put out a call to invite folks to come in and help them out. But I actually do have a few friends, and one in particular who I've been in touch with still in Ukraine. She lives in a smaller village about an hour outside of Lviv in the western part of the country. And, you know, she would go with her family into the cellar. They have a cellar. And I check in with her. I try to check in with her about every day. And it's funny. There's been a few, you know, missile attacks in the western part of the country, increasingly close to the Polish border. There was one when I was there a few weeks ago on a Sunday, and then there was just one this past week. And I said, how are you doing? Like, are you in your cellar right now? And she said, we're just too tired to care about the bombs right now. We're not going into the cellar. We're too exhausted. And I think she said that there's, you know, people in her village that share that sentiment too, because even though I think we have not seen, you know, Lviv be shelled at all, you know, in the same way. The city itself hasn't seen that at all. But there are still air raid sirens that are going off often, even when there may not be a bomb that actually hits the city. And so I can imagine, right? It's just exhausting to constantly be in and out, in and out, in and out. You're not sleeping. But, you know, even in her case, I think her sister-in-law is imminently having a baby like any day now. And it was just, you know, she's just trying to go on. I mean, she's in the hospital, just sort of waiting, and just like, you know, anyone would be doing when they're waiting to have a baby. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously I can't speak to like millions of people who are still in Ukraine, but I think that there is definitely a sense of fatigue, I'm sure. I mean, just how completely exhausting that must be. And yeah, there's a level, honestly, too, I think, of like a bravery and boldness that I've experienced even when I was there before the war that I think you just really don't see often when in the U.S., to be honest,
Caitlin,
when it comes to, yeah, those challenges. So
I want to thank you so much for spending your time with us this morning and sharing what you saw over in Poland near the border. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Caitlin Farrell from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Find her next stories there. Up next is news. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Last year, there were 643 overdose deaths in Milwaukee County. That's more than the homicides and the suicides and the car accident deaths combined. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And it's not just Milwaukee County. We don't have statewide numbers yet for last year, but in 2020, the Wisconsin Department of Health counted 1,227 opioid deaths. Maybe you know or knew someone dealing with this addiction, whether you knew it or not. So what needs to be done here? What can be done here? And where can those we know go to get better? Join the conversation, 1-800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Jay Ford, an assistant professor at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. His research focuses on expanding the use and adoption of practices to improve patient outcomes and quality of care. Hey, Jay, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
Let's begin with the role that methadone and other drugs like it can play in treating opioid addiction. What makes methadone effective, as you see, Jay, in treating opioid addictions?
Well, one of the things about methadone is it's kind of a long-acting opioid agonist. So it's something that's going to help the individual with an opioid use disorder, you know, reduce their craving. And it's going to help, with withdrawal and kind of blunt and block the effects of the opioid that they're taking. Methadone as a medication is something that individuals have to take on a daily basis. So they have to go, and either take the medication in a liquid or a tablet or a kind of a powder or diskette form. But it's something they have to do, you know, in person. And somebody actually has to see them take the medication.
So it sounds like there's a process to use methadone and to start the process of recovery. So give me some idea in the eyes of somebody with an addiction, what steps they take to get to being able to use methadone in a recovery program.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So first of all, methadone, like many of the other medications, was approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. But what's unique about methadone compared to something like buprenorphine or naltrexone is it can only be dispensed at opioid treatment programs that are licensed by the Substance Use and Mental Health Services Administration at the federal government. So in Wisconsin, there are about 20 to 25 of these organizations. Most of them are in the Madison, Milwaukee, or kind of up toward the Fox Valley area. But someone who is taking methadone would have to typically, get up probably fairly early in the morning, drive to the closest opioid treatment program in the state. They would wait in line until the program actually opened, and then they would go in and typically they'll have a urine drug screen or a urine drug test to make sure that they're not on opioids. If that comes back, negative, then they'll be given the methadone dose either as a liquid or, as I mentioned, a powder or a diskette form. And then they'll take that in front of an individual within the opioid treatment program. So the idea, what they're trying to avoid by doing that is someone diverting methadone, to somebody else. So then the person leaves, but then they have to come back and do that the next day. So this is an ongoing daily basis that people have to go through to get their methadone. You know, works great, maybe if you're in a city like Madison or Milwaukee, where it's a little easier to get to.
It sounds like barrier after barrier for people. Yes. Who we would be trying to eliminate these barriers towards recovery. And we wonder why we have an opioid epidemic and why it's difficult to get our hands around it. And there are many aspects to this, but one would be getting people into a system for recovery. And one of the easy, or at least most available systems for recovery would be at least starting a replacement therapy to get away from street drugs, which we, as we know, have become increasingly deadly with fentanyl supply. So, Jay Ford, from your position here, why are there more barriers for using methadone versus some of the other drugs you've mentioned? And I've heard from others saying they prefer the other drugs, but maybe that's just because of the process here.
Yeah. So, each one of the kind of the three main medications for opioids have their own barriers. We talked a little bit about methadone. Someone who's on buprenorphine, which is another medication, they can only get that from a physician that has gone through specialized training. Whereas a medication like naltrexone is something that a provider, a nurse practitioner, could prescribe to an individual, and they could get that without the barriers. I think some of these barriers, exist from a system that was, created long ago. One of the issues might be that, about 40% of the OTPs are run by for-profit companies, which is fine, but, moving away from that model is going to hurt, their bottom line. But the idea that someone has to get up, 5:30 in the morning to go get a medication, for a chronic condition is crazy, because we don't, if we're a diabetic or an asthmatic or with high blood pressure, we don't have to go to a specialized clinic every day to watch somebody take our medication.
So what I'm getting from you, Jay Ford, is that we have some outdated rules that in some way may be impeding our opportunity to work towards getting a handle on an opioid epidemic that is becoming increasingly deadly on the streets.
Yes, I think that's true. I know that there's a push at the federal level to relax some of the, or to continue, not relax, continue some of the rules that were put in place during the COVID-19 pandemic. Especially as it relates to access to methadone and other medications. People are looking at ways to, continue to allow, take-home methadone that was occurring during the pandemic and other things. So people, the SAMHSA and the federal government, are looking at ways to maybe waive and put some of those rules into place permanently.
And you would be, from your position and your work, you would see that as an effective you would be supportive of this relaxing of these restrictions for the purpose of dealing with this opioid epidemic and, people who are struggling with addiction?
Yeah, I think the more we can do to increase access to medications for opioid use disorders that people need, the better. I mean, there are just too many barriers that exist in the systems, to allow people to easily access the medications. And so there are opportunities to improve that. And I think the more that we embrace and try these new ideas, the better off we are in terms of trying to address the ongoing opioid epidemic.
So we're talking about how drugs for opioid use disorder are distributed with Jay Ford. He's an assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, and we invite you to join us. Have you undergone treatment for opioid use disorder? And what barriers to access have you faced when trying to get drug treatment? Share your stories. They may help. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us ideas at WPR.org. Jay, one of the things that I've heard, but I haven't heard you mention yet, is Suboxone, another a replacement therapy drug that would be available that I've heard some prefer to methadone. And I'm wondering, again, is that because of the drug itself or the barriers involved?
Suboxone is, a different type of medication. And so typically that is something that has to be dispensed as part of kind of the larger buprenorphine family but it has to be dispensed by a physician or a nurse practitioner who's undergone specialized training. And those individuals typically can only see a certain number of patients on their panel. So while it's better and somebody can go get that and maybe get a 7-day supply of Suboxone that they can take at home without that direct supervision, there's still barriers in place to getting access to that. So I think in terms of Suboxone versus methadone, it really is, comes down to kind of the medication that's going to work best for the individual. Some people are more tolerant of something like Suboxone than they are methadone. But others prefer methadone because it provides them with an accountability that they feel like they need on a daily basis, in terms of taking the medications.
And you alluded to this, Jay Ford, and I want to ask you directly about the pandemic. And I mentioned how, we're just beginning to understand because of the isolation that comes with addiction and the isolation that came with pandemic. It wasn't abundantly clear or immediately clear. And we've seen the same thing with alcohol addiction recently. I would ask you how you see the pandemic affecting not just the opioid epidemic, but how the distribution of methadone and other replacement therapies available to begin recovery.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, that impacted it most likely was just, people's general access. I mean, I think the treatment programs did their best to, stay open and provide services, but, they had to get a little creative because some of these services, might also come with having a counseling session with a licensed behavioral health specialist, a social worker, to talk through some of the addiction issues. Well, the ability to meet in person, went away. So then you had to kind of start thinking creatively about the use of telehealth or other mechanisms to provide this connection for people. So I think you had that going on, but you also had individuals, isolation. So there wasn't, maybe there wasn't accountability for someone who was struggling with an opioid or an alcohol use disorder of someone who could actually, help them, get the help that they needed.
Jay Ford, our guest, assistant professor at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison, taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Taking a look at access to methadone and other drugs that can be effective in beginning the process of recovery for people who are struggling with addiction. What questions do you have about what we can do to reduce the barriers and begin the process towards recovery for those who are seeking it? 1-800-642-1234 to join us. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Last month, Democratic Senator Ed Markey and Republican Senator Rand Paul introduced legislation that would ease the rules around the distribution of methadone, a replacement narcotic used to treat opioid addiction. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is Jay Ford, assistant professor at the UW School of Pharmacy. Have you or someone you know had any experience in dealing with methadone clinics? And if you're in recovery, please share your story with us. It may just help provide a roadmap for others. 1-800-642-1234 to join the conversation, or you can email us ideas@wpr.org. And Jay, Wisconsin is set to receive over $400 million as part of three separate settlements now. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services says expanded treatment options are a priority. If you were in charge of this purse, how would you see that money spent?
Wow, that's a good question. One of the things I would look at is, really working with and across the healthcare community, in particular, there are pharmacies in almost every community, and pharmacists are trained to, dispense medication. And I think that's one of the things that's in the act that you mentioned that coming back into this segment is the Bipartisan Opioid Treatment Act is you know, is encouraging to allow pharmacists to dispense, you know, methadone to people from the opioid treatment program. You know, so that's one thing I think we can look at, you know, maybe trying to figure out how can we expand, you know, access to other medications like buprenorphine or Vivitrol. There's some of these medications that are long acting injections. So I think, you know, providing access through either pharmacies or other healthcare providers is a way to do that. You know, one of the other things that could be creative is actually take the medications to the individual. So this idea of, you know, creating a maybe a mobile medication van, you know, for people who don't have access and actually go to these individuals and bring, you know, bring the access to them rather than having somebody have to drive, you know, hours to get to an OTP if they're taking methadone. You know, maybe you take the mobile van to them and they only have to drive to somewhere in their local community to get that. So, you know, I think those are just some ideas off the top of my head about how we might use that money.
Sure. And Jay, I want to ask, do we have enough access to detox services for people who are dealing with opioid addiction or opioid use disorder?
In my opinion, no. You know, there are a lot of wonderful, you know, treatment programs, you know, across the state. But a lot of them are limited by capacity, whether it be bed capacity, whether it be capacity of trained staff like physicians who need to be able to prescribe methadone or buprenorphine. And then even, you know, trained staff to work with these individuals. You know, there's a lot of great people that are working in the field, and I've met a lot of them both in Wisconsin and across the country, but I don't think they have all the support that they need, you know, to do that. And so I think there's more that we could do to look for opportunities to expand these services, you know, in all corners of the state.
Let's go to your calls and questions now at 1-800-642-1234, where Lori in Madison is standing by. Lori, you're on the air with Jay Ford, assistant professor at the UW School of Pharmacy.
Hi, yeah, thank you. I'm just calling to talk about my concern. One of the huge barriers I see is just the immediacy to treatment. I feel that when an addict decides that they want treatment, you know, having to wait for an appointment is a barrier. I mean, when the person is ready for treatment, it's like you have such a sweet spot to get them into treatment. And when they have to wait, you kind of lose that opportunity. So a real huge barrier is just that lack of immediate access to treatment.
Lori, I appreciate your call. Thank you. And that window, Jay Ford, and as you work on your research focuses on expanding the use and adoption of practices to improve patient outcomes and the quality of care, what do you think about that window and how we have to get people into that window, as small as it may be?
Yeah, Lori is really right on in terms of what she's talking about. When I first got into the field, oftentimes people would have to wait, you know, weeks or longer, you know, just to get an initial appointment for somebody to come in and screen them, you know, to determine whether or not they are, you know, even eligible to get services. You know, some providers have moved to a walk-in, you know, clinic model, which I think helps reduce some of those barriers, but they still exist. I mean, especially if someone needs, you know, residential inpatient treatment, that's a strong issue of access to beds. I think it's more prevalent, most likely in the state, in terms of adolescent treatment beds. So, you know, going back to your earlier question, you know, that might be another opportunity is to try to look at, you know, residential treatment programs in the state and expand where necessary, whether that be for adolescents or adults.
Lori, thank you so much for the call. Still time for yours at 1-800-642-1234. And Sean from Green Bay had a note here about people he knew who were taking methadone, but also still using intoxicants. Whether or not that is, you know, something that you've seen, Jay, that methadone is being used, but there is still a lack of a recovery process there.
I haven't seen that personally, but I'm not surprised that, you know, some of that's going on. I mean, you know, the methadone is designed to block the cravings for opioids, but, you know, someone could still be, you know, taking other medications or dealing with other, you know, co-occurring issues. You know, maybe their opioid is being blunted, but they're still, you know, drinking and have an alcohol issue. So yeah. I'm not surprised that of that going on.
Let's go to Pete in Green Bay. Pete, you're on the air with Jay Ford from the UW School of Pharmacy.
How you doing, Jay?
I'm fine, Pete.
Hey, I was talking about the money that the state's getting. Unfortunately, I've got a son that I deal with addiction. It's been going on for probably 5 years. He's 24 years old, or 25. So probably a little bit more than that, actually, as far as the length of time. But I've taken him in where he's wanted to go in and tried to get him to detox at a couple different places, went through the emergency rooms at a couple different places. And the emergency rooms will not, the hospital systems won't take a opioid addiction for detox. Their thoughts are that, you know, they'll get them in there for 72 hours and then, you know, they leave the hospital back to using again, which may be valid, may not be valid, but, there seems to be a lot of roadblocks in trying to get into a actual detox area where he really, you know, had made the choice to, I'm going to do this, you know, and we get to the hospital and then only to be turned away. You know, and I've done that a couple times with him. So maybe, you know, some more treatment on that end of it. I'm not sure how it would work. But the other thing is he's in a methadone program right now that works well for him. The barriers that he had originally a couple years ago about getting into the methadone program don't seem to be there anymore, like costs and paying up front. But so at least he's in a harm reduction phase. I'm not saying that he doesn't still use because he does, you know, they use marijuana and that. So he's got other things going on along with that. But he does not miss going to the methadone clinic. So at least for now, that's a plus. So that's a lot there, and I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Pete, I very much appreciate you sharing your family story. And, Jay, we're just about out of time here. So what can you say to Pete's experience?
First of all, Pete, thank you for sharing that. I know it's got to be very challenging. And unfortunately, I think it's relatively common. I think there are, you know, inherent challenges in the system that really do need to be addressed. I mean, we don't face these challenges if we're trying to get help for other chronic conditions.
Yeah, and something to keep in mind. Jay Ford, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Assistant professor at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. Just ahead, we're talking about hospice care and Medicaid, and what questions do you have about end-of-life compassionate care? That's after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.